Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 12. Now, we were talking about your time at the prisoner of war camp, and there are just two incidents. One is this crash there. You saw a German aircraft crash. There's a bit of a story about that. Do you want to tell us that story?
Yes. One night, it was been a very stormy day, very low scudding clouds, and we were all locked in for the night, and we had the an aircraft, and we looked through the, because there used to be shutters outside, and they used to be closed and locked at night together with the door, but I was at the other end of the billet, but we heard this aircraft, so I went down to the other end to have a look out, and the perimeter lights were on, of course they were shining in the clouds, on the low cloud, quite a glow. And it seemed to me that this aircraft was flying back and forth, thinking maybe we were an airfield. It obviously was lost. So having flown up and down and around the camp for about 5 or 10 minutes, it then sheared off, and we saw although we couldn't actually see the airplane, we could see his landing lights, and he was extremely low. So he obviously decided, we could see this through the top of the shutters, through the window, top of the shutters. And anyway, he obviously realised this wasn't an airfield, and he was obviously also getting short on fuel, because he flew off, and then we could see in the near distance, still through the space at the top of the shutters, the landing lights go up into the clouds and disappear, and then we could hear the engine screaming, and it came. We see the landing lights then coming straight down. So it came straight down in a vertical dive and obviously crashed a few miles from the camp. Well, because everybody cheered, German aircraft has crashed. Next day, the German commandant sent a note in to Vic Clark and said, thank your men for cheering when they saw their comrades in the Luftwaffe bail out from their crashing aircraft. Well, of course, we never saw anybody bail out. We were cheering because we thought we'd seen a German airplane full of German aircrew crash. But that was an incident that broke the monotony a bit.
Now, did you get parcels or things sent out from 15 Squadron RAF?
Yes, there was it was known that I was a POW. My mother then heard from the squadron. We had a fund every payday. There was a box on the table, and we could put in two bob or half a crown, and it was for comforts for any of the 15 Squadron who survived and became POWs. So the intelligence officer ran this little fund. So he wrote to my mother and said, what sort of books and records did I like? So she wrote back and said, I like swing music and sort of thrillers or whatever. And I've got the letter upstairs, which he sent back to her, saying what they'd sent to me. And it was a James Hedley Chase, and I think a book, an Artie Shaw record. And they sent cigarettes. Now, I didn't smoke. My mother didn't tell them I didn't smoke. So one day, I didn't know this was going on, of course, at that time. This packet arrived for me, Fry, all in it, and opened up with blooming cigarettes, 500 cigarettes. Well, that had also been opened, and some of the cigarettes had gone. I thought, well, what the hell am I doing with these? I used to give them away. There was nothing much to trade with them anyway. But I've still got the labels off them. And then I never did get the record or the book. But I got another two lots of cigarettes, would you believe? So I got three lots of 500 cigarettes, but not the things I really wanted.
And what did you do with the cigarettes? Just give them away or
gave them away. Yeah, I didn't. I might have, now and again, there used to be an auction. Chaps would get stuff they didn't want. For example, I went down, bought a tin of brilliantine, solid brilliantine. But by and large, I gave the cigarettes away to my friend Peter Lucas or Danny Heath, or whatever. I didn't want them, no good to me. And I couldn't trade with the Germans at that time.
Now, did you get paid camp money, and was there a camp shop?
No, there was nothing like that. There was no camp shop or money.
Now, what about the whole question of escape? And we'll come to in March the news of the Great Escape, but
yes.
It's separate.
Yes.
Was there any question of an escape committee or escape activities at the camp?
No, there was. Well, there was, but it was all low key. If you didn't need to know, you didn't know. That was the end of it. But there was always some activity going on. In fact, they started in my block at the end, in hut 6, at the end of my block. In fact, the room where my flight engineer was, they started a tunnel there because they used to come round collecting bedboards for the lining of it. So we ended up with hardly any bedboards. But the Germans found that. But A Lager, which was the first lager of the camp, I don't know much about it, but they had some things going there, okay. I think there may have been one or two successful attempts from A Lager, but I'm not sure.
Now, was there any question of you getting involved in escape? Were you keen to escape, or were you just not?
Never bothered. But I think, once more, it's a question about philosophy of us new prisoners. You see, we felt that we were only there on a temporary basis, and we didn't see really much point in getting deeply involved in any escape attempts. But there was always something going on. There was in a camp, it just had to be that way. You know, there was the sort of XYZ service that they called it, where the coded letters would go out and coded letters.
Now, tell me about that.
There was a system organised. Certain chaps in the RAF and the various squadrons were approached by the intelligence people and taught a code, so that if you ever shot down and survived, they could write back home, and if there's any information that would be helpful to our people at home, they could put it in their letter to their next of kin, and that would be passed on, and that was that was very successful because the Germans never broke that code. So there was if there was some activity going on, perhaps movement of troops or a new aeroplane may have been seen, anything that could have been helpful to our intelligence people could be put. But I wasn't I don't know anybody that actually
did you know of the system though at the time?
Yes, we knew of the system.
Now, what about, did you have a camp wireless?
Yes, that we had, and that was in A Lager, the other lager, the first lager. And we used to get daily bulletins from that, for BBC. That was the Canary, and the Germans never found that either.
These were from the BBC, the bulletins?
Yeah. Yes.
Did you find that useful to know what was going on?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And what about the news of the greatest? Is that the next thing that happens? It is in your memoirs after Christmas. I mean, is that the next thing you remember?
Yes. We on the afternoon parade, roll call. The commandant came out in the usual way. Vic called us to attention, and he strutted out, and he unrolled his paper like a scroll, like this. I see him now. He's only a short fella, this German commandant, little fella, oldest guy. And he read out this question of the escape from Luft 3, and that 50 had been shot, either trying to escape or evading capture. And of course, the mood then changed. It was, you could have cut it with a knife then, and Vic Clark had to call upon us to calm down and be quiet, because in case that we did something silly, which was possible, especially amongst the older prisoners. So that was rather a sad incident, really, to know that these chaps had been murdered. We knew they'd been murdered, although we couldn't believe that they'd all been killed trying to escape, because we didn't believe it anyway. Of course, that's how it turned out when we got the full news of the dreadful business. So that was another incident that occurred there, up there.
Anything else happening during that spring and early summer of 1944?
No, I think, except that then we came, in the the winter turned to spring, of course, and then summer was good, very good. So we used to spend quite a lot of time outside sunbathing. In fact, some of the chaps were up the end of the compound, they used to bathe, put their blanket out on the ground and bathe in the nude, sunbathe in the nude. And where the German barracks were, farther away from the camp, they must have had either their wives or sweethearts or popses or whatever there, because a couple of German women were walking past the barbed wire on that side where the chaps were, and they complained because these chaps were lying there naked. So the German commandant put a stop to that. They're not allowed to bite somebody naked. Oh dear. But it was a good summer, and so
volleyball gets a mention here. I mean, was that again volleyball?
Oh yes, well, because there was all sorts of things going on. Apart from that, we had a volleyball net, so we used to muck about with the volleyball now and again. It's all part and parcel of filling in the day and trying to keep fit and so on. And this one day in June, I was out. Fairly early in the morning, after roll call. It was a horrible day, low scudding clouds, windy rain, drizzling rain, and I was out there and a couple of Scottish chaps, they were in fact paratroopers captured in the Middle East, but they'd ended up in the Luft camp, and we were out there playing about with the volleyball, and that's when we heard a great shout go up. The Germans had a loudspeaker sort of between the compounds, although they never actually used it up to this particular point, but it was announced over the German radio that there'd been a landing in France. And of course, there was a tremendous roar went up with the chaps who understood German, who'd heard it from A Lager. And we were in I and these two Scottish chaps were messing about the volleyball, and that's when we heard the announcement of D-Day. That was the 6th of June. So that was that. So the German radio was saying, and this was in the morning, so they'd already landed. And the German radio was sort of hinting that it was they were getting on top of it, and there were.
Now, how did you hear German radio? Was that played out of the camp, or?
Yeah, there was a loudspeaker in between the camps, where the camps sort of joined up in the corner, as it were. There was a loudspeaker there on a pole, like a big tannoy. So, and the German radio was making out it was going to be a sort of a Dieppe fiasco again. But of course, we had our Canary, and we knew what was going on.
The Canary's the...
our secret radio. So we were getting the true gen from the BBC.
How did you feel about D-Day?
Fantastic. Absolutely marvellous. We thought, that's it. Be over by Christmas, we'll all be home. But of course, it didn't turn out that way, but... We were always optimistic, you know. we knew we could beat them anyway. So.
Did you have any worries about what would happen, though? I mean, how they'd treat their prisoners, you know?
Well, we'd already been told time and time again, when they come in and did their strafe and tipped everything out and did their searches, the Gestapo, their officers were always telling us that when we win the war, you're going to be carted off to Berlin to help rebuild Berlin. So we knew what we would be in for if they did win. We would have been worked to death rebuilding Berlin and Hamburg and places. So, we were under no illusion as to what would happen in that event.
But were you not worried if the British won that they might just shoot you?
Well, there was always that. You always, as a prisoner, no matter how quiet it may be, you're not interfering with the Germans and the Germans not interfering with you. They, don't forget, they've got the guns and they get their orders. So, unless you're an absolute idiot, you must know that you're on the sticky end of anything, really. So, yes, you must always have that in mind, really.
Now, did you develop any particular camp speciality? You know, like some people worked on Climtins and all sorts. I mean, did you have any speciality?
No, I didn't, no. Most of us didn't. You see, a lot of this stuff has got to be kept for your eyes only, if you like, on that basis, for obvious reasons. The least people who know about these things, the better it is for your security. you see, and maybe the success of whatever you're going to do.
But you weren't in the gardens or doing things with Clementines or...
No.
You're just normal prisoner of war life, as far as you're
That's all, yes.
How was your health standing up to it?
Very good. The only problem I had was just before Christmas, the first Christmas I had there, I developed this diarrhoea, sort of dysentery, which was a bit dodgy because I ruined my underwear and I was a bit under the weather for that. So that lasted a few days, but that's all. But that was more or less norm for chaps to go through that sort of thing. But apart from that, I was pretty good. In fact, when you're young, you're healthy anyway, because the Polish doctor, when I was fit and been moved to the other room with the other chaps, as previously mentioned, he said to me, because he spoke good English, he said it was your youth and your fitness that saved you. So that's fair, speaks for itself, really, doesn't it? So, yeah, that was good. So that was only a little uncomfortable, and there was nothing you could take for it. If you went to the doctor, he only gave you a couple of aspirin. He didn't have anything to give you. So we got over that all right. So we've had D-Day, that's June, and so we were getting our daily reports from the BBC, so we know the chaps were doing well, and hopefully everybody else, the RAF and so on. And then...
Now you were in East Prussia, that's where the Russians were heading towards. I mean, exactly. Were you aware of this?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. So the... came the day when they said we're going to be purged from the camp because the Russians were advancing.
Now, when was this, roughly?
This was, I think we left the camp on about the 16th of July.
44.
And the we'd heard a couple of days previous to that.
Now, what preparations did you make for evacuating yourself? I mean, the Germans are making their own. Well, what were you doing?
We didn't do anything. It was in the summer. Of course, the weather was warm and good, so we didn't do anything because we didn't get all that much notice anyway. But for some, there's a peculiarity here because most of the chaps that I'd come from Dulagluft with, Ginger Lucas, for example, and the others that filled the first. Three huts of the new compound, they went with a lager when we left the camp. They went with a lager and they went by train to another camp at a place called Thorn. Whereas I and a couple of others, for some reason that I really don't know, we were told to go to keep with K lager chaps. And they were all the chaps, as I said previously mentioned, that came from Bath. The previous year. So I was with them. So I was separated now from the chaps that I've known.
And where were you going?
And so we didn't know where we were going, except obviously they were going to take us west. And already we could see on the skyline out of the camp, we could see refugees coming from the east and going west, away from the Russians. By that time, they were approaching Vilnius, I think it is, the city. And so they were getting fairly close. So we entrained, we got the cattle trucks from Heidekrug station down to Memel, which was Memel at that time, Lithuania. And we arrived there at night and we were put on a ship called the Insterburg. And a lot of us tried to stay on deck. The sick chaps were allowed to stay on deck, but the rest of us had to go down in the hold. So since I was one of the last down in the hold, down this ladder into the hold, one of the hold, the forward hold, I think I was in. There was no room left on the floor, so I had to find room on the side of the ship. There was, I think they're called strakes. Part of the framework of the ship is like a girder, and it's about 3 or 4 feet off the floor of the hold, and about 3 foot long. And I perched up there for the rest for the 3 days and nights that we were on this ship.
Now, what were conditions like in that forward hold?
Fearful, It was jet black, of course. It had been a collier, this thing. So it was dirty, very dirty. There was one light bulb, dim light bulb, for light. And the toilet facilities was a bucket lowered on a rope. And also there was water lowered in a bucket on a rope. And that was it. And other than that, we were battened down in this place. And it was pretty grim, actually, pretty grim. So,
did you have any idea what was happening or where you
no
were?
No idea. We didn't know where we were going. We knew we were on a ship, and on the Baltic, but we didn't know where the ship was going.
Was it rough, the sea?
No, fortunately it was calm. Fortunately, phew. But what we didn't know at the time, I don't think, was that the Russian submarines were active in the Baltic. So we were lucky we got there. So anyway, we arrived 3 days later at Srinamundi. Port of Srinamundi, and tied up there, and the cattle trucks were already on the quayside, and next to us at the quayside was the Prince Eugen, the famous cruiser Prince Eugen. Just as we were getting into the cattle trucks, the sirens went. It was cloudy. The sirens went, and we heard the Americans going over, and the guns opened up. They started a smoke screen, the Germans, these smoke pots they started, and the Prince Eugen's guns opened up, but they were soon gone over, and so that was that. That was the incident there. Saw a submarine go past, going out to sea. Because it was a Kriegsmarine base as well, Srinamundi. So we got into the ubiquitous cattle trucks again, and off we went. We didn't know where we were going, of course. So we came round up there, up the Oda, across a bridge, past Stettin. From the cattle truck going past Stettin, we looked through the... There was an aperture in the side of the car truck, and we could see a big aircraft carrier being built on the other side of the river. And they were building an aircraft carrier, which it looked almost complete. And I think it was called the Graf Zeppelin, but of course they never completed it.
It was never launched, was it?
I mean, no.
What made you think it was nearly complete is a way of saying it.
Well, because it looked like an aircraft carrier. You could see it was an aircraft carrier. So it got to that point where it did look like an aircraft carrier. And I learnt later it was called the Grouse Bay. It was going to be called the Grouse Bay. Anyway, or was it the Grouse? No, Graf Zeppelin it was going to be called. The
Graf Zeppelin, yeah. Sorry.
Graf Zeppelin it was going to be called. So that was interesting to see that. And that came to nothing, of course. So eventually we ended up... sailing at a place called Kiefheide. Got out of the cattle trucks there. We were given our boots back, which they'd taken from us. Lined up, counted again, and then marched off. Well, as we marched off, we got onto the road that was obviously leading to the camp we were going to. We didn't know what it was or where it was. We saw all this kit strewn all over the road. Incredible, all the stuff that the chaps had brought with them from Heidekrug, all over the road, and we wondered what the hell had gone on. And there were still guards either side of the road, which were woods, and also there was a cameraman there. We saw a cameraman. And as we got farther up the road, we passed this, there was a bend in the road, and there was a car parked there. And this German officer, his name was Picard, Captain Picard, Hauptmann Picard, yelling and shouting and firing his pistol in the air. He was going to start raving mad and cursing and blinding us. And when we, all the way, about 3 kilometres or more, till we got to this camp, there's all this stuff strewn all over the road, incredible. And when we got there, all the chaps were outside. They were sitting on a grass verge there. They were, some of them were bleeding. They were in a terrible state. All their kit had been cut from their backs and so on. And they were in a terrible state. And a lot of them, we'd learned that the guards had been, the Luftwaffe guards had been augmented by some Kriegsmarine, young Kriegsmarine thugs from the naval base, and they had fixed bayonets, and they'd been stabbing the fellows, cutting their gear from their back, stabbing them, bashing them with their rifles. One chap, a Canadian, had his rifle smashed over his head, actually, he was bleeding profusely from the head. Other chaps have been bayoneted several times. The dogs have been bitten by dogs. They're in a terrible state, and they've been abused all the time. And these are the terror fleegers that have bombed your women and children in Hamburg and Berlin and God knows where else. And it was an awful sight. But the incredible thing was that the group that I was in, we just went up, marched up the road normally with normal guards. The other lot had been manacled together in twos. So they must have, when they came to us, we got out of our cattle truck, they must have run out of manacles, presumably. And of course, all these vicious guards had gone up with the first column. So we got away with it lightly. I was lucky, my luck was holding out still. But when we got there, it was absolute shambles. Anyway, we were milling about outside. It was a boiling hot day. They eventually marched us into the camp. And of course, a lot of the chaps had to have medical treatment for their bayonet wounds and so on. When we got in the lager, it was the American lager. And it was already overcrowded with Americans. So what they'd done, the Germans, they'd put up big dog kennels in between the huts. And they held 10 of us. We were sleeping on the floor, and you couldn't stand up. There was no door on them, and you couldn't stand up in them because they weren't high enough.
Now, this was where? This is
at... And this turned out to be Stalag Luft 4.
And that's at Grosser...
Grosser Tischau.
T-Y-C-H-R-O-W.
Yeah, yes. Yes.